Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I hope you can read this sentence. Dave Keeling wrote this in 1968. The rise in CO2 is proceeding so slowly that most of us today will very likely live out our lives without perceiving that a problem may exist. Isn't that amazing that the guy who knows the most about CO2 in the world, as he started in 1968, he could see that by then he could see the trajectory going up of CO2, but even he had no sense that by 2010 we would be in the human predicament we are now. And I found when I first read that sentence, I was stunned that how naive and innocent we all were back in the 1960s compared to what we look at now. And so what I'm sure probably everyone in this audience is aware of is the iconic Keeling curve of atmospheric CO2 measured on the top of Mauna Loa. You know, it's hard to overstate the significance of this one data set. I will bet any earth science graduate student, you could just draw a line like that with no axes, with no units at all, and they would know what it is. This is, for earth science, like the DNA helix is for biology. And it's so well known that in the scientific circles doesn't need any introduction. What I want to have us look at tonight, because probably many of you haven't looked at this Keeling curve in detail, is I want to talk about these interannual variations, the interannual variability. And it's interesting that when you read of Dave's initial measurements back in 1956 and 1957, there was another group, I think it was in Sweden or Norway, that was also trying to make measurements. And their best measurements were about plus or minus 100 parts per million. In other words, the error of their measurement was so huge that they would have never seen what the Keeling curve exhibits to us about, first, the trend upward, the unmistakable trend upward every single year that it's shown us. But then second, they've developed a measurement with enough precision that he could see this fluctuation from year to year. And I know he, by 1959, if I remember right, had observed that and had the first concept that that might be a biospheric signal. So that's what we're going to talk about here. Now, we start with an understanding of the anthropogenic CO2 emissions. This is our latest estimate. Fossil fuel going up ever since 1960 relentlessly. A lot of people don't understand that there's also a measurable CO2 emission from what we're labeling here as land use change. And that's a combination of wildfire, of agricultural burning, of deforestation for a variety of reasons worldwide. And you'll notice that it's not an insignificant number. It's certainly not as large as fossil fuels, but it is a significant component of our carbon budget. So when we, as earth scientists, look at our annual carbon budget, we recognize that there's somewhere in the 1.2 to 1.4 petagrams, 10 to the 15th grams per year, coming from these land use changes. And the major component, around 7.7 petagrams per year, is fossil fuel emissions. Now, we as earth scientists try to figure out where it all goes. And turns out that only about half of it ends up in the atmosphere. The other half, or a bit more than half, we think, is being absorbed currently by the land biosphere and by the oceans, both chemically and by biological activity. So the land and oceans are taking up about half or more of the emissions that are occurring worldwide. And I would hope the first thing you would come to you is, if these carbon sinks go down for whatever reason, that means the atmospheric CO2 would start rising even faster for the current emissions that we have, not to mention increasing emissions. So as a terrestrial carbon scientist, what I try to understand is, okay, how is this land carbon sink functioning globally? How well are we confident that it's going to keep functioning? Is there any way we could get it to do more for us? And so that's what I'm going to take us through in the next few minutes, is a bit of how we measure the terrestrial carbon uptake and with what kind of precision we can take these measurements, and hopefully something about how we can maybe help in the future. Now, back to Dave Keeling's seasonal variability in that curve. That was, of course, the famous Keeling curve is only at Mauna Loa. Now these measurements are taken at, I want to say 100 sites worldwide, something close to that. And so now we can see that there's differences in that seasonality worldwide. So here's an example from Point Barrow, Alaska. And you'll notice how huge the summertime uptake of carbon dioxide is by the biosphere. And then you go to a place like New Zealand, there's hardly any seasonal cycle at all. And so what's going on here? We're going to figure this out. Now, one of the things that is helpful to understand, and it's illustrated nicely by this climate animation that NCAR and Boulder does, is there's a couple of key points. The first thing is you get the sense, if you can see some of these atmospheric dynamics, that the atmosphere is well mixed, as we call it. Basically, we did a cool experiment in 1980 up by my end of the country. We had Mount St. Helens go off, and that came right over the top of my town. And one of the things that was interesting was 14 days later, the ash cloud came back over. Now, you couldn't see it the second time around by the naked eye, but the scientists could clearly measure it. And it was a perfect illustration that the atmosphere goes around the entire world in only a couple of weeks. And so no matter where a CO2 emission source starts, it is mixed into the atmosphere hemispherically very quickly, much more quickly than I think we understood 30, 40 years ago. A couple of weeks and that atmosphere is fully mixed. Another critical factor in these atmospheric dynamics is that the northern hemisphere atmosphere and the southern hemisphere atmosphere hardly mix at all. There's almost no, vertical mixing isn't the right word, latitudinal mixing, almost none. The atmosphere doesn't cross the equator. And so that means that all of your carbon sources in the northern hemisphere stay in the northern hemisphere, and also, the carbon sinks are stronger in the northern hemisphere because there's much more land area. 3/4 of the Earth's land mass is in the northern hemisphere. So when you go to the southern hemisphere, if you've ever been down under, the sky's a lot clearer and a lot more blue than it ever is here anymore. I'm sorry to say it reminds us of our atmosphere of probably 50 years ago. But it also is this imbalance of the Northern Hemisphere landmass to the Southern Hemisphere landmass is a lot of why that New Zealand cycle that I just showed is almost flat, whereas the carbon cycle for the season up in Alaska is very large, is because of this difference than the terrestrial landmass. All right, let's get past that, and we can go to our kind of big overall look at the global carbon cycle. And we've already talked about these emission rates and the atmospheric growth. The big thing we're looking at now is the land sink. That's CO2 being taken up by the biosphere, and the land carbon sources, which are a function of both land use change and natural processes that I'll get to in a minute. The other point I found when I speak to the public on climate change, I found that people don't have a good sense for it all, is of the entire Earth climate system, the atmosphere is the smallest part. And I like to use this space shuttle photograph because it gives you a nice perspective. Look at how thin that atmosphere is over the huge, we're only seeing a tiny part of the Earth's surface here. But when you think about it, the atmosphere, the bulk of it's only about 5 miles thick. Well, 5 miles horizontally on the ground is nothing. And yet that's all we have for an atmosphere. And quite simply, we're just filling up the smallest reservoir of the Earth system with the carbon emissions that we're producing now. And so we will then look at the stores of carbon in various parts of the Earth system. And I want to just make clear that the biggest, I mean, without looking at details, you see these tiny fluxes here going into the smallest component, the atmosphere. And look at these huge numbers for ocean carbon. This is one of these are these methane clath rates that British Petroleum is having trouble with right now. Look at that number. And you start thinking about more of that bubbling out from the bottom of the ocean. And, of course, coal, oil, and gas also. 10,000 petagrams in these stores. We're talking about an annual flux of a few petagrams, and yet we have stores of carbon that are tens of thousands of petagrams in these underground reservoirs. If these ever get to the surface, then the global CO2 concentration goes to thousands of parts per million, not 380 or 390. All right, let's get to the scale that I work at and think more about the trees. And so we, from a tree's point of view, the carbon balance is pretty straightforward. Photosynthesis takes up CO2. Any green plant generates photosynthetic activity, is absorbing CO2 and to grow plant tissue, but it also has respiration costs. They're living organisms, and so they have a respiration cost for their metabolic activity. So you have a net of carbon uptake that has to measure both the incoming sink of carbon from photosynthesis and this outgoing respiration of the living biomass. In addition, you have decomposition from dead material in the ecosystem. So this is what we call heterotrophic respiration. And so any organic matter, any dead organic matter, is decomposing at some rate, and that's emitting CO2 also. And so when we try to understand the carbon balance of the terrestrial, of the forests, we're trying to put together these components and come to a final source or sink measurement for that piece of ground. Now, this is how I started. This was my master's thesis work. This is before the age of satellites and big computers. And so when you wanted to measure carbon dioxide exchange of a plant, I had a little bitty cuvette that I would put a tiny twig in this cuvette, and I could measure the CO2 evolution and the water vapor exchange of just this tiny little twig. And that's, I used to work on Christmas trees, as you could see. And for my PhD, I moved up to trees maybe 5 meters tall. But I was still not even measuring a single tree. I was measuring a few twigs on a single tree. And so this was the scale that we could do terrestrial ecosystem carbon exchange measurements in the early 70s. Now, what we've moved to since are what are known as eddy covariance flux towers. And if you ever were to see one, you'd think you were just looking at a real fancy weather station, because they sit on a weather tower, and they take normal measurements of temperature, humidity, sunlight, wind speed, all that. But their critical measurement is they measure wind speed exceedingly carefully, and then they have an infrared gas analyzer that measures the concentration of carbon dioxide and water vapor in the atmosphere very carefully. And this is the same apparatus that Dave Keeling used at Mauna Loa, was the infrared gas analyzer measuring CO2 in the atmosphere. These generation work on these flux towers, and so they are measuring by tiny eddies of carbon dioxide flowing into and out of the canopy, and they measure these every few seconds. And so you're getting a very precise measurement of CO2 coming in, CO2 going out by these small fluxes of the atmosphere and the concentrations of CO2 and water vapor. And so there's now about 400 of these towers around the world. This map from about 2 years ago shows this is, for terrestrial carbon science, this is really the I hate to say the fad of the decade, but this is clearly the big new technology of the last 10 to 15 years, because it does give us a very direct measurement of the carbon sinks and carbon sources anywhere we put one of these towers. And so now they're all over the world. They're a very good companion to the measurements, like the Mauna Loa measurement of Dave Keeling's measures the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. These are measuring the fluxes of that CO2 to the surface and out, because of their measurements of wind speed also at very high precision. So in the United States, the longest record of these flux tower measurements comes from Harvard Forest now. And so you can see again the kind of annual cycle that Dave first saw in his Mauna Loa record for at a global scale. They now see the same sort of seasonality: high up take in the summer, low uptake in the winter, high respiration in the summer when it's warmer and wetter, wintertime periods that are rather dormant and have very little activity. And so you can measure this to very high precision in these towers. You end up with being able to represent a seasonal cycle of any landscape, and starting from January 1st, these are two seasonal cycles for a forest in Michigan and Colorado, you see a very clear growing season. Early spring green up, a midsummer peak, senescence in the fall. And so anywhere these towers are located, we can we then are able to measure on a daily and even a finer resolution these carbon fluxes by these stations. Now, the problem where I started into this was that even when you have 300 or 400 of these stations, we have 110 million square kilometers of vegetated land surface on Earth, and 400 doesn't sound very big. And so what I've started working on, oh, probably 20 years ago now, was some simplifying logics. So how can we take this plant physiology that we understand really pretty well, the basic controls of these physiological processes, and how can I make this, how can I generalize it so that I can look anywhere in the world without having to put another one of these $100,000 flux towers in? So we started looking at measuring and quantifying in a real simple way the basic controls on plant growth. And any gardener here, this is going to be absolutely routine to any gardener. We know that for plant growth, you need water, you need light, and you need temperatures above freezing. In fact, here it has to be way above freezing. In Montana, just above by a degree or two is good enough. I've got my trees in my yard are finally starting to bud out. We haven't yet had a day that's made 60 degrees yet, but our trees have gotten tired of waiting and thought they'd give it a try anyway. So what we did was we came up with a simple quantification of temperature controls, and really on a global basis, freezing temperatures are the most fundamental control for plant growth and in many cases plant survival. And so this is something that we know from weather stations worldwide quite accurately when freezing temperatures occur and when they don't. Another thing that is so simple it's hard to look past is that a plant has to have light for photosynthesis, and we can calculate day length very accurately for any place on Earth. And from all of our weather observations now, we measure solar radiation everywhere on Earth daily also. So we need adequate temperature, we need adequate daylight and sun, day length and sunlight, and then a plant has to have a big available water supply. And that turns out to be the trickiest part. I always envy my ocean colleagues because they don't ever have to worry about water stress. The constraint that I spent my career trying to figure out is they're just don't worry about from square one. They don't even think of the concept of water stress. It doesn't even occur to them. But in our land plants, drought is the biggest signal that we see that isn't seasonal in nature, and we'll see more of that in a minute. And so we built these algorithms that could compute these constraints from below freezing temperatures, from short day lengths and low sunlight, and then water availability. And then we go anywhere on Earth and we can calculate the kind of the approximate growing season of that area. So what I have up here are two sites, a Russian boreal forest, and this color coding, this green shows when the day length is too short. So up in the boreal forest, it's too dark in the wintertime. And then as the light returns, for a while it's too cold. And then finally it warms up enough that then their growing season in the midsummer is successful for on the order of 3 or 4 months. And then it starts getting cold and then it gets dark again. The same simple logic you can then take and go an African savanna as another example. Here you're at you're so close to the equator that you have hardly any darkness in wintertime. The day length is almost equivalent year-round. It's always warm, so you never have any temperature constraint. The main thing that matters in the African savanna is that water stress. So whenever they have a big drought cycle, there's very low growing season potential, and then when it rains, it improves. The point here is we can do this everywhere on Earth, and we've done it everywhere on Earth, and we can then stand back and generate a pattern of effective growing season capacity for the terrestrial biosphere based on these fundamental limits, and this is the sort of thing it looks like when you do that. So this was the beginning of my thinking of how to get beyond my little Christmas trees and that little cuvette that I could only measure one little twig. And my next measurement was from the top of this. This is NASA's Earth Observing System. Charlie Kinnell was in the middle of all this and in the EOS era also. This is the launch of the first, the Terra satellite in December of 1999. And my job as a science team member for one of the satellites was I wrote a set of algorithms in effect to mimic what I just showed you about these simple growing season constraints that you can describe for plant life anywhere on Earth with these three variable controls. And what you find, this was kind of my eureka moment of my career, was when I did this first graph in 1988, comparing an early satellite vegetation index data set, which I know you can't discriminate the different lines. The main point is all the lines have the exact same growing season dynamic in this graph. So I'm graphing daily photosynthesis, daily transpiration of water vapor, and then the satellite vegetation index. And when this graph came up on my computer, I knew that we could, from a satellite base, do a mapping of terrestrial productivity worldwide that would have some credibility, because you boil it down to these kind of simple controls that I've described. So, from these kind of logic, this was a paper we had published about 5 years ago of the first 20 years of the global satellite record before our new satellites, and the areas of the Earth that appeared to have done better, the higher latitudes showing some increase in primary productivity, or net NPP is our formal label for this carbon balance that we measure with land plants, and areas that have lost during this 20-year trend had shown a negative trend in primary productivity, and that's primarily caused by large-scale drought. Now, what we now have is 10 years of record from that satellite, and so this is what our data set looks like, and you really see the planet, if this is kind of the representation of Lovelock's Gaia, that you start feeling the planet as a single organism in its own right, and you see this seasonal pulsing of the biosphere. And of course, Dave Keeling was the first person to get a sense that the biosphere had enough strength, shall we say, in carbon sink for this kind of dynamic to occur. And he saw that from just those first couple of years of predictable seasonality in his Mauna Loa CO2 curve. And so he would always come up to my lab in Montana as these first few years of this data set came about. And it was really a thrill to show him from his Mauna Loa curve to now how we can monitor the entire planet. And I didn't mention, but this is the ocean data set also. There's an equivalent primary production by a group at Oregon State University that does the ocean. So this is the land and the ocean being shown in this animation. Now, where this gets pretty interesting is when you then match up the year-to-year anomalies of the direct CO2 measurement, the Mauna Loa CO2 curve, in black, against our net primary production in red for the 10 years of our satellite data set. And so this, we're just getting ready to send this to a big journal and get famous, or we won't get rich for sure, but maybe we'll get famous. And this is really getting to be an interesting look at how the interannual dynamics that we can compute by satellite is giving us the same coherent signal that Dave was getting in the CO2 record at Mauna Loa. And so this is really an important step of scaling between these point measurements on the ground and full global observations. All right, now I was supposed to talk about forests, so I better get going on forests quick here. And so let me now turn. You understand that we can now monitor globally these terrestrial carbon sources and sinks. We're trying to follow the photosynthesis and respiration balance all season long in places worldwide. And now let's go and look at a forest that certainly that I follow carefully, the Rocky Mountain Forest. This is a springtime image on the eastern front of the Montana Rockies. And it shows that it's very green for about a month, and that's about it. One of the things that has been found, in fact, Dan Kyan is here on the faculty at Scripps, and this is one of his papers, is that the growing season of the temperate ecosystems, not the tropics, but the temperate ecosystems, has lengthened by on the order of 2 weeks. And so gardeners in Montana get 2 weeks that they didn't have 50 years ago. They've planted a vineyard about 3 miles from my house. Don't buy any of it. The grapes don't die or anything. So we don't have a climate that just kills them like we used to, but the wine sure isn't very good. So I guess the Chamber of Commerce, let's hope they don't watch this clip. But our growing season is getting longer, and this is a worldwide phenomenon. Europe, Siberia, all around the higher latitudes, say about 30 degrees north into the high latitudes, has shown this pattern worldwide. The big issue for us, and this is where I start coming to the next dimension of our terrestrial carbon sink in the Rockies, is that our ecosystems live on snowpack. Our summer rainfall doesn't amount to enough to carry our ecosystems, and so they live on our snowpack. And this is a paper that came out a few years ago showing the decline in April 1st snow water equivalent over the 50-year period, 1950 to 2000. And you see all around the Pacific Northwest a 20 to 40% decrease in April 1 snowpack. And this used to be the peak of the snow for the winter. It was right at April 1 before the snowmelt started. A big paper, another Scripps faculty, Tim Barnett. This was a paper Tim had in Science 2 years ago, analyzing both the Rocky Mountains, the Cascades, the Sierras, and coming to the same overall conclusion. Springtime temperatures are increasing. In Montana, the the March temperatures have gone up 7 degrees Fahrenheit, seven in the last 50 years. And so March has warmed more than any other month of the entire year in our part of the world. And what that then means is the snowpack's melting earlier and melting faster. And of course, this shows that the rivers are then peaking earlier. Now, what happens when you rely completely on snowpack for your river flow is now our rivers are running out of water in the late summer. And if any of you come up to Montana for the blue ribbon trout fishing, it's getting to be more and more an issue that the rivers are running dangerously close to dry by August. And often our Fish and Game Commission has to close fishing for weeks at a time because the river flow is just plain too low and the water temperature is too high. And so it all starts with our spring snowpack. And that spring snowpack we're losing little by little. This is the day our IPCC report came out in 2007, and a reporter wanted to talk to me, and so he went to 7,000 feet on a north-facing slope, and that's the snowpack we had. And it was a classic illustration for him what the problem was. I did a talk to a Lewis and Clark history group a number of years back. When Lewis and Clark were going through this area coming back from Oregon in 1806, they were stopped by 12-foot deep snowdrifts in June. And this is March, and there's nothing at 7,000 feet. We had another winter just like this. Just this last winter, we've had almost no snowpack. We're getting snow now at the end of the winter and early spring that's catching us up a little bit. But the big problem is this. Wildfire. You've probably never seen a wildfire looking down from the space shuttle. This is another one of the space shuttle images. And this, for us, to me, is the greatest potential for really for human human vulnerability in the West is wildfire. And I don't need to preach wildfire to Southern Californians anymore. I think your governor said that the fire season now is year-round in California. It's almost year-round in Montana. 2 years ago, we were having a wildfire outside of Billings in January. It used to be 30 below zero in January, and now we have wildfires. And so a quite widely quoted paper that was done right here at Scripps also by Tony Westerlin and a group here found that the fire season in the West is now 2 months or more longer than it was 30 years ago. There's a fourfold increase in the large fires. They're burning six times as much acreage. And a tricky part of it is the biggest increase is in higher elevation forests. For us, it's not the low elevation savannas and grasslands and chaparral like it is here in California. For us, it is forests that used to be snow covered. This picture behind here is at about 9,000 feet. Our subalpine forest couldn't burn decades ago because the snowpack would last till July. By the time the snow melted, it was still sopping wet through most of August, and then it started getting cold in September. Done. That was the summer. Now we're having these summers where we start the summer with no snowpack. That landscape starts desiccating from right now. And by July, we're having fires like this at elevations we never would have been able to burn before. And so this is what I see as the biggest vulnerability we have in the West here. And this is all through the West. This was part of Tony Westerling's paper. I did an analysis with him for my paper, and we're seeing all through the West the same sort of trend, the mountains of the West. Snowpack is the best fire retardant that we ever have come up with. And now that we're losing that free natural fire retardant weeks earlier every spring on dry summers, it just means our mountains are really going to be ready to burn. Now, in our part of the world, most of the ignition is lightning. I don't think that's the case here. But the case still is true that if your ecosystem has to be dry enough to ignite before you start having fire problems. And I think we're now throughout the West having a greater percentage of the year where the ecosystems are dry enough to burn. And this is, so I live in Missoula here. The Keeling Ranch is right there. So this, any of you that know Montana, this is going down the Bitterroot River. And look at the fire scars from 1 year of burning. These are fire scars all around from the 2000 fires. And we, in the last decade, we've had four big fire years. The kind of years that we would have 1 year out of 50. And now we've had 4 out of 10 years. And so, and I'm afraid this summer isn't starting well either. And so when we have a big fire year, huge parts of our mountain landscape can burn in one summer. And of course, again, Southern California, I don't need to explain wildfire to you folks like I have to in other audiences. You know full well what the potential for major fire devastation is. Now, returning to our carbon balance, when you have a fire, this is a model sensitivity we did that's a little hard to follow. But what we were doing was simulating a forest for 100 years, from 1900 to about 2000. And we simulated with the changing climate, you know, it warmed up a tiny bit, with the changing atmospheric CO2 increased a little bit with a lot of variability, and then we simulated a fire. And the pulse of carbon flux from a fire just dwarfs the CO2 trend. It dwarfs the global warming, the pure temperature trend. What I explain to my audiences in Montana now is the big impact to our forest is not pure warming. It's the influence on triggering a higher disturbance dynamic as we're seeing with our fires. Now, unfortunately, we now, and Ralph mentioned it as we started, we now have an additional disturbance dynamic that really has only started in about the last 10 years, and that is major forest insect epidemics. This is up in the whitebark pine in Wyoming, and I have to confess, my wife makes me confess, I'm so colorblind I can't see the dead trees in that picture, but she assures me that this is all full of dead trees. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, good. These epidemics started up in British Columbia. So I have not been up here. I need to go up. I guess you can go and see hundreds of square miles of dead trees up there. And that started as early as 1998. So this epidemic started there, has gone down through the West, actually hopped to Colorado. And I was seeing him in the Colorado high country 6 or 8 years ago, and is now backed in and is arriving in Montana. And you see just tremendous acreages of dead trees like we've never seen before. It's important to understand that these insects are always endemic to these forests. They've always been around. This isn't some invading rogue insect from the tropics or something like that. But they have been able to develop into epidemic populations, we think, for three reasons. And the first reason is that it doesn't get cold anymore in the winter. Around Montana, Montana has always been famous, or maybe infamous, for brutal, punishing cold winters. And we like to, whenever a Californian comes up, we make sure we tell him about it, because that usually sends him home faster than anything else. But I'm here to confess that we used to have temperatures of, say, 40 below zero a couple of times a decade, 30 below zero almost every year, and 10 to 20 below zero half a dozen times a winter. Our absolute low temperatures have warmed up 15 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 50 years. That's the biggest temperature signal I've seen yet. And what that is those low winter minimums. They've come up stunningly. Now you can all come up and buy cabins. It isn't that tough anymore. And they're actually real cheap right now. I guess everything is cheap here too, is what I understand. But what happened is those occasional really cold temperatures would freeze the larvae of these overwintering insects. And so the populations could never get much momentum, because the majority of the larvae, 98%, would be frozen every winter, and the population just could never get started. Now we've lost those brutal cold temperatures. It's so far the only good thing about the cold temperatures that have been identified, but unfortunately it's a pretty important one for our forest ecosystems. On the other end of the calendar, this longer dry summer that is triggering the forest fires also triggers carbon stress in the trees. The trees are drought stressed. They can't produce pitch. If you've ever wondered, why does a tree produce pitch? What's the purpose of pitch? Well, now you know. Pitch is a tree's defense from invading insects, but they have to have a carbon source to make the pitch. And long, dry summers that drought stress the trees are reducing their ability to make pitch, and the insect hordes are magnifying because of the easy winter temperatures, and you put both of those together. And the third part of the recipe is forest stands of a middle to advanced age, where they're susceptible, where they're basically kind of over the hill, kind of like me, and so they've reached a point of declining vigor naturally, and particularly the lodgepole pine forest of the Rockies, by about 100 years of age, reach this point because the stands grow in a really dense fashion, an exceedingly dense fashion. So those are the three factors. The populations that make it through the winter, dramatically easier. The longer growing seasons that stress the trees, and I should add, allow the beetles to go through more life cycles per summer. They can sometimes get even two life cycles in a summer rather than one. And the third being large expanses of middle-aged declining vigor trees. You put all this together, and this is what we now get. And we're seeing it throughout the forests of the West. We just had a paper analyzing forests worldwide, and we're seeing these kind of evidence of mortality rates over expanses that we never have seen before in our careers. A paper that analyzed background mortality rates, a permanent plot records of the Forest Service all throughout the West, and you can, I think, see that for all different species, locations, locations, ages of trees, elevations, every different which way they cut and sliced and diced this data set, they're showing about a doubling in the background mortality rate of these permanent plot records. And this is before you get into the big epidemic issues. And so we really are seeing this odd situation where we have a longer growing season. Our trees are actually growing a little faster, and yet we're having this new disturbance dynamic that certainly is taking back everything that these forests gained in their somewhat large, faster growth rates were losing in spades with the disturbances of both wildfire and insects. And so, for example, the Canadian government was getting real excited when some of the cap and trade carbon policies were being talked about, and they had visions of carbon credits dancing in their heads like Christmas. And then one of my colleagues up there, a forest ecologist, wrote the $100 billion paper that illustrated that their insect and wildfire disturbance dynamics were accelerating faster than any of this growth, forest growth, and that basically the Canadian forest could no longer be counted as a carbon sink. They might even be a net source. And when I read that paper, I thought to myself, you just cost your government $100 billion of carbon credits with one paper. And he was just pointing out the truth. What we now understand of the dynamics of our forests is that, yes, they grow and absorb carbon nicely when they're growing well, but they're also, these disturbance dynamics are clearly accelerating, and that really negates that increased growth entirely. And so what we worry about from the global carbon balance point of view is this natural land carbon sink that I started the lecture with. We think so far it stayed pretty level. The ocean sink, they think, is declining some, and I'm the wrong person to ask why. But there's people here at Scripps that know why. My job is the line on top here, the land carbon sink, and we think on a global basis it's still staying stable. What we would love to do is make it stronger. It would help humanity out tremendously if it was stronger. But what we better really make sure doesn't happen is that these sinks get weaker, because that means of all our emissions that we're generating, more and more will go to the atmosphere faster, and that atmospheric CO2 increase will even accelerate. And so nowadays, I think of how Dave started the original carbon monitor for the planet with one station at Mauna Loa. And now this is the sort of terrestrial carbon monitor that I think we have all the components to do right now. Every one of these pieces of measuring land cover change and the growing season, as I talked about, monitoring primary production, as I showed, these flux towers all around the world. These components exist, but this in no way is coordinated as a global monitoring program. If international policy goes seriously into carbon cap and trade with major carbon credit mechanisms, they better have something like this in place for monitoring, or all these policies may or may not work, and who will know? And so we are seeing, I think many of us in the earth sciences are returning. A lot of this audience is of the age that they remember the Limits to Growth book. How many people read the Limits to Growth in college? Yeah. This is a newer version of the same theme. that it really is time that humanity start looking really hard at what our planetary boundaries are. A number of variables have been suggested for this diagram of this paper came out just before the Copenhagen conference last year, and measuring things like ocean acidification, chemical pollution, land cover change. The important part here is the concept that we think that limits to growth idea from back in the 70s was asking the right question, and it's time for us to ask that question again and really try to determine in a very rigorous way what the planetary boundaries are, because the consequences of exceeding those boundaries are not good to contemplate. And so I have to end with, I sometimes think, I wonder how long, if Dave had not started the Mauna Loa record, how long it would have been before some other measurement was started that would have got us a clue that we are now having a planetary impact. And I really think that he almost single-handedly gave humanity a 20 or maybe even more than 20-year head start on learning to understand the Earth system. And it's sure clear that we needed all the head start we could get, because as we all know all too well, we still don't have solutions. And so I think you can't overstate how important that Mauna Loa curve was to wake us all up. And I think, as Ralph said, a number of us here, our entire careers are were really triggered by Dave Keeling's Mauna Loa record. And it was always so much fun when he would come up to my office. He never kind of got to the electronic age. He would have his troops here at Scripps do graphics and then fax them to him up in Montana. And when he'd come to my office, he would have a stack of these faxed graphs and a plastic ruler. And that was it. And we would look, and he would look at this. This looks like the acceleration is going up this way. No, it's going down that way. And I always told my students, someday you will remember these days with Dave Keeling and realize that was the best mind you ever saw at work. And so I really, it's a thrill for me to give this first talk and honor his legacy, because it certainly, if humanity makes it through the next century, he has a lot to do with how we made it. And this is going up the chairlift with me at one of our conferences about 5 years ago as my favorite picture of him. And I guess my other favorite picture is this one. This is the most distant picture of Earth ever taken from a billion kilometers away. A satellite that was exploring the rings of Saturn pointed back, and I don't know how they figured this out. Charlie, you probably know how they figured this out. But how they figured out that that's the Earth a billion kilometers away.
They knew where it was.
they wouldn't have found Saturn if they didn't know where Earth was.
And remember, the antenna was pointing at that.
And it just reminds me that we don't have any other options if we screw up this planet. So thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.